Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. It was another ho-hum year for politics in North Carolina. The Republican nominee for governor, Mark Robinson, spent the final months of the campaign answering questions about porn shops and porn message boards as the rest of the GOP kept Robinson at arm's distance. Roy Cooper ended his eight-year tenure as governor the way he started it, in a legal fight with state lawmakers over constitutional separation of powers. Republicans went from evenly splitting the state's 14 congressional seats to taking a 10-4 majority. Somewhere in there, Donald Trump beat Kamala Harris by 3 points after both presidential candidates and their surrogates blanketed North Carolina all year long. The horrors of Hurricane Helene, 100 deaths and $50 billion in damages, also spurred political controversy, all of which sets up a high-stakes 2025 with questions aplenty. How will Josh Stein and the legislature get along, or will they? What will courts decide about the lame duck legislature's SB 382 passed this month? A bill that shifts power from the governor, attorney general, and other offices held by Democrats to Republican officials. And what of Cooper's much speculated on future? Will the former governor challenge two-term Senator Tom Tillis in 2026? Oh yeah, and by the way, will we ever learn the results of the Allison Riggs Jefferson Griffin Supreme Court race? On these matters and more, we are here to help. Today, we welcome three reporters immersed in state politics and poised to make some semblance of sense of all of this. Lucille Sherman is a reporter at Axios Raleigh. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter at WUNC. And Brian Anderson is author of the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter covering state politics. Good morning and welcome to all of you.
Morning. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
As I just mentioned, we have a lot to look back on and a lot to look ahead to in state politics. Let's begin with Mark Robinson, who made a lot of headlines in 2024. He lost to Josh Stein by 15 points in November. Here is Robinson's response in September to a bombshell report published by CNN that revealed a history of sexually explicit, homophobic, and racist online commentary.
And folks, we've seen this type of stuff in the past as well. Clarence Thomas famously once said he was the victim of a high-tech lynching. Well, it looks like Mark Robinson is too, by a man who refuses to stand on stage and debate me about the real issues that face you. Instead, they want to focus on salacious tabloid lies. We're not going to let them do that. We are staying in this race. We are in it to win it. And we know that with your help, we will. God bless you. And we will see you where? On the campaign trail.
So I'd like to hear from each of you on both Robinson's candidacy and whether you think his troubles affected any other candidates this cycle. And Lucille, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I think we can say with almost certainty that his candidacy did affect other candidates this cycle. I think some folks have argued that perhaps Robinson cost Republicans the supermajority in the legislature. They're about one seat short in the state house. And it's because Democrats immediately sought to tie Republicans to Mark Robinson sort of after this scandal broke in September. And they gave them enough time to do that too. You know, they had about a month and a half before the election to sort of spend time tying those candidates to Robinson.
Yeah, I think the it's pretty clear that, you know, attorney general race, Dan Bishop, who at one point said he would be Mark Robinson's sidekick, that remark got replayed over and over again to tie him to Robinson and helped, I think, Jeff Jackson, the Democrat, win that race. Similar dynamic in lieutenant governor race, where at one point, Hal Weatherman, the Republican candidate, had all these signs that said Robinson Weatherman, as if they were running as a ticket together. That, of course, was a bad political move after all the scandals came up with Robinson. So I think any candidate that could be tied to Robinson did get tied to him. And I think that had a lot of effect on which Republicans didn't win. The Republicans that did have a good year for things like state treasurer, state auditor, those were the Republicans who were probably the least like Robinson and the least closely aligned with Robinson of all the candidates on the ballot.
I mean, as you alluded to, there are still races we're waiting for certification on, and that shows how things can be decided just by the thinnest of margins. And when you have a big, major gubernatorial scandal, that can be enough to shift things Was it enough for the state Supreme Court race? You could point to Robinson and a number of other things that may have impacted those. But certainly in Republican circles right now, there's a lot of hand-wringing and people frustrated about Robinson.
Now, Robinson asserted that Stein was involved with this CNN story. Is there any reporting or any evidence that that is the case?
I have some knowledge on the story behind the story a little bit. I can say this is something that has been brewing for months and months and months in Democratic circles. And this was really a story that was timed closer to the election, which is not an uncommon thing. If you're a political operative, you want to get the maximum benefit off of your oppo research. And that tends to happen in September, in October, which is why when we get close to these November elections, we see some of these late breaking stories that have been known to political insiders and operatives for months and months and months. What I can say is that I have not seen any evidence that Josh Stein was directly involved in getting this CNN story out. That's not to say there weren't Democratic operatives who supported Stein, who wanted to get the story out. But I have not seen evidence directly to date that Stein himself planted some sort of story here.
Yeah, and I think the Stein campaign, if they knew the story was coming, they certainly didn't know when it was coming. CNN did a lot of legwork on this. It took them a while to sort of connect all the dots and feel like they were ready to drop their reporting. So the day the story dropped, Stein's campaign actually had scheduled a big press conference for Republicans who were going to be endorsing Josh Stein. And of course, within about an hour, that story was minor news. No one was paying any attention to those endorsements by the time the CNN story came out.
And help me on chronology here. I think that afterwards, Mark Robinson did sue CNN. He threatened to sue CNN. Did he actually sue them and then drop it later? How did that?
I think it's still pending. Is that right, guys?
Still pending. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. In the weeks after, time feels strange in the lead up to the election. But in the weeks after the story dropped, he did ultimately sue CNN, and that lawsuit is still pending. There's some debate about whether that lawsuit should be moved to federal courts or state courts. I think it's in the Robinson camp's favor to keep that lawsuit in North Carolina. And so it has sort of, we're still sort of waiting for the next move in that lawsuit.
And he also sued a source who was quoted in a story from the Assembly about Robinson visiting supposedly these video porn shops in the 1990s or so. And so that person was included in the lawsuit as well. It's one thing that is just worth noting is that many Republicans, including Senator Tom Tillis, had pushed for Robinson to prove that these claims about him were false. Robinson to date has not provided any evidence supporting that. There's a plethora of IP address data and other data that would seem to support these allegations being true. But so far, Robinson has sued without evidence that these stories are false.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. You know, the lawsuit is a culmination of the immense amount of pressure on Robinson to prove that this was false. And that was one step in doing that. Eric, just one more thing before I might be jumping ahead, but I feel like it's worth noting with Robinson too, there were a couple of ads that the Stein campaign ran earlier in the election cycle that really hit him hard. And one of them is a video that Robinson had posted on Facebook, just a selfie live stream of him talking. And it has this quote that says, it's sort of taken out of context. It's obviously not the whole quote, but it says, basically, abortion is about women not being able to keep their skirts down. And the Stein campaign, I feel like, and others in the state feel like, sort of nailed Robinson with that. And his polling numbers slid after that ad played throughout the summer. And so it looked almost as if Robinson was slipping before the CNN story came out. And that story was really the nail in his coffin.
Yeah, I'd argue that he was going to lose anyway, but the CNN story was the reason he lost by 15 points as opposed to 5 points or 7 points.
Absolutely.
And this was just a campaign that was sort of doomed from the start and how its operations were. Even like a month or so before the CNN story, I had reporting out about divides within Robinson's own political orbit, I'm in my 20s, nothing against people in their 20s, but when you have someone in your 20s who is your right-hand man, who is being publicly criticized by fellow Robinson supporters, that's not a good sign of the way the campaign is going.
That's the voice of Brian Anderson. He is the author of the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter. Also with us is Colin Campbell from WUNC and Lucille Sherman from Axios Raleigh. North Carolina lived up to its purple reputation in 2024, as we're just explaining some of that, as Democrats won races for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, superintendent of public instruction, and secretary of state. Half of the council of state offices, while Republicans retained large majorities in the legislature, although not the supermajority in the House. Which of those results stand out the most to you? Go ahead, Brian.
There's a lot of ones that stand out. I think a couple big legislative ones, Tricia Cotham winning her race may have come as a surprise to a lot of people, given the amount of money that was spent to try and oust her, given all the Democratic backlash and that she was in a pretty toss-up district. So I think that may have caught some people by surprise. Given the makeup of the district, it's not a huge stunner that she won. I just think that may have caught people who had expected the backlash to be insurmountable. They might have been caught off guard by that. The other race I think that may have surprised folks was in Senate District 42 over in Mecklenburg County. You had a pretty Democrat-friendly district. That was the seat for Rachel Hunt. And that was ultimately, it looked like it went to a Democrat. We're still waiting on final certification, but it was by the thinnest of thin. We're talking less than a percentage point difference. So I think those are the two biggest maybe legislative newsmakers to me.
Yeah, I'd add to that the state auditor race. I think was interesting that you had the incumbent Democrat lose in that race. Didn't get a lot of support and funding from some of the bigwigs in the state Democratic Party, so she didn't do as well as Democrats did in other races. And the result of that is we have Republican Dave Bullock getting sworn in. And as of this week, hiring a lot of former staffers from Senate Leader Phil Berger's team. So some interesting alignment between the state auditor's office and the office of Senate Leader Phil Berger coming our way.
Yeah, and we mentioned it earlier, but the state attorney general's race had all the makings of a race that I thought would be much bigger news. But just based on how the governor's race went, I think it sort of fell by the wayside. Mm-hmm. The results of that race are really interesting. It was between two congressmen who are now former congressmen. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of the makings of a race that was going to be very fiery, and it just felt a little sleepier than I expected.
I definitely agree with you on that one, Lucille. I thought that was going to be a knockdown, drag out. And I think you're right. The governor's race overshadowed that. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the presidential race because everybody talks about the presidential race, but Trump did double his margin from 2020. And I'm curious whether that was a surprise to any of you having lived through both campaigns coming through here ad infinitum.
I won't say I was surprised. I still feel like on election night, I wasn't exactly sure how things were going to go, but I was surprised that North Carolina was the first battleground state to be called. I felt like we had been called pretty early in the night. And I will say that is what was surprising to me, just the amount of decisive win here in a state where Trump's margins of victory shrunk between 2016 and 2020. You know, it felt to me like maybe those margins would shrink further, but that is not what happened.
Yeah, I think winning the race. Go ahead.
Colin, I want to get to your thought as soon as we come back. We have much more to discuss about not only that race, but others and looking ahead to 2025. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFA.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we're continuing our look back at the year in politics in North Carolina and what's ahead in 2025. My guests are Lucille Sherman from Axios Charlotte, Colin Campbell of WUNC, and Brian Anderson, whose Anderson Alert Substack newsletter focuses on state politics. Colin, I apologize. I cut you off. Go ahead and share your thought.
Yeah, I think what we were talking about, you know, to what extent we were surprised by former President Donald Trump's win in North Carolina and his margin. I don't think I was at all surprised that he won North Carolina, given how things have gone the last few times. I was surprised that he increased his margin, because we were going into election covering some of these rallies that the candidates were having here almost every day. You saw a lot more enthusiasm at Kamala Harris's rallies. Trump's rallies didn't have quite the same vigor and enthusiasm as it had 4 and 8 years ago, but that didn't actually hurt him when it came down to the polls. He ended up doing better, even though people were leaving the rallies early or they just weren't as excited to be there as they were before. So I'm not sure I necessarily know the exact reasoning behind that, but that seemed to be sort of the overall trend, I think, across the country.
Got it. And I apologize. I said Axios Charlotte because I'm so used to seeing it in my inbox. Axios Raleigh.
No problem.
I mentioned at the start of the show Hurricane Helene, which obviously was the biggest story in the state of any kind, but it had a large impact on politics as well. We had, conspiracy theories and factually incorrect rumors that were running rampant right after that storm, and it's leading into the election season and how will people vote and will the voting work? In the end, what influence did Helene have on the political turnout and the political results, you think?
Well, Hurricane Helene may have given Democrats the ability to break the supermajority, and that's because of the victory from Lindsey Prather over in Buncombe County. She was in a very red-leaning area after redistricting when Republicans redrew it to a pretty lean GOP seat, I would say. But with Hurricane Helene, she really put in a lot of work into the community. People saw those efforts, and that could have been the difference between 71 House seats for Republicans and 72. So that's the sort of macro view of how Helene may have affected the next 2 years of state policy. But obviously, we have seen a tremendous backlash to the lack of money in the legislature going towards Helene recovery, especially with Senate Bill 382, which shifts $227 million from one fund to another, but doesn't actually spend that money. There was some backlash to that. That was obviously after the election. So certainly some impacts before the election and after to watch.
Yeah, I will say it's so hard to say, obviously, or parse, you know, what impact Helene had. But I do think it's worth noting that there was so much frustration, whether it was mainly on the internet or on the ground, about the federal presence and the state presence in the mountains after Helene. And I wonder, you know, how much credence that gave Donald Trump, who was a part of, you know, criticizing the state and federal response after Helene. We also saw Mark Robinson sort of after the CNN story broke, on the ground, or saying that he was on the ground, having video cameras following him around. That ultimately didn't help him. So I feel like it's a little bit of a mixed bag in the aftermath.
On the congressional delegation, I think most of us who follow politics knew that it wasn't going to stay 7-7. We knew the new maps were coming. It wound up being 10-4. As you think about the rest of the decade, does this look like where we will be as a state for until 2030, until the next census?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be any more court cases. I mean, there may be some attempts, but unlikely that anything gets a whole lot of traction between now and the next census. So I think this is sort of baked in to where every 2 years we're going to have a big battleground in the first congressional district up in the northeastern corner. That's the seat that Don Davis won a second term to in a pretty close race. And then the rest of them we pretty well know is going to stay Republican or Democratic going forward. So it's really going to be either 10-4 or 11-3, with Republicans having a pretty big majority. And that's, you know, with a narrow majority for Republicans in the U.S. House as a whole, there's a pretty strong argument that that redistricting shift to give Republicans those extra seats was a big help to them getting a narrow majority in Washington as a whole.
The final piece of 2024 I want to discuss before we look ahead to this year is the end of Governor Cooper's tenure after 8 years. He could not run again due to term limits. 2 weeks ago, he delivered a farewell address in his native Nash County. Here's part of what he had to say.
I went from getting sued in my first few weeks in office by Republican legislative leaders for trying to expand Medicaid to welcoming those same leaders to the mansion on a beautiful spring day 6 years later to sign the Medicaid expansion bill into law.
So for each of you, let's just go around the horn. How do you think Cooper's governorship will ultimately be judged? What's your best guess?
For me, from the people I've spoken with, you know, it seems like it's going to be viewed with a mixed bag. Obviously, he did his best in spite of GOP supermajorities at times, which hampered his ability to enact policies he liked. And he'll be remembered, obviously, for Medicaid expansion. That will probably be among the top of the list of things people remember about his governorship. But he'll also be, I think, remembered as someone who had struggled with hurricane recovery and response, and we had seen a lack of progress in eastern North Carolina, some backlash to hurricane in western North Carolina toward the end of his governorship. So those are probably the two longest lasting impacts of his governorship.
Yeah, I'd echo that. I do think, you know, Hurricane Helene happening sort of at the end of his tenure sort of refreshes in everyone's mind the other hurricanes that his administration had to deal with. And I'll be interested to see how much that's sort of talked about in reflecting on his tenure. I also just think fights, he alluded to it in talking about Medicaid expansion, fights with the Republican legislature were huge, a huge part of his administration. And I think the way that he handled his relationship with the legislature is admired, you know, from Democrats across the country. I think it is one of the things that made him rumored to be a contender for vice president after President Joe Biden dropped out of the race and Vice President Kamala Harris was elevated. So I think those are things that will also, he'll also be remembered for, you know, whether he wants to be remembered for that or not.
Yeah, I think certainly Medicaid expansion is his biggest policy win. But with Republicans in charge, he didn't really have that many policy wins from what he ran on as far as his agenda. What I think he'll probably be remembered from most is for to be the crisis governor. I mean, he's the one who led us through the COVID-19 pandemic for 2 years. He was on TV seemingly every week, you know, trying to deal with that situation, whether you agree with the shutdowns and the restrictions or not, and ditto for hurricanes. I mean, he came into office right after 2016's Hurricane Matthew. We're still dealing with the impacts of Matthew and Florence in 2018 and people who are still not back in their homes. And then the other book into his, as Lucille mentioned, is Helene. So it's, you know, he's led us through a lot of natural disasters and a lot of, you know, public health disasters.
Yeah. Just one more note is that Medicaid expansion, I think the latest number is 600,000 additional people on health insurance in North Carolina. That is a massive number. And his administration certainly had a hand in that.
And a lot of rural residents in that number.
And I was just going to say one other thing that the Republican legislature and Governor Cooper are both going to take credit for is the number of jobs that have come into the state, North Carolina becoming more of a business friendly place, especially after House Bill 2 fallout, when that was when Cooper had then taken office in 2017, he had to deal with that. So I think both sides will try and claim credit. And the correct answer of who is to credit is probably a mix of the two.
Yeah, they love those CNBC rankings when they come out every year. That is the voice of Brian Anderson. Also with us is Colin Campbell and Lucille Sherman. Okay, turning to 2025, a natural segue is that Cooper and his successor, Josh Stein, are already heading to court over the General Assembly's passage of SB 382. That was the relief bill that includes big changes in election oversight and limits on the attorney general taking legal positions counter to the legislature. This is a cruel question in a way, but how do you think this gets resolved and how long do you think it takes for this to get resolved? Who am I going to be mean and pick on first? Lucille, I'm going to pick on you first.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we've seen, you know, there have been battles after battles of almost this exact same topic, the legislature having power versus the governor for years. And so some of those battles were still playing out when this one picked up. So I think it could be a long time before we know what's going to happen with this. But something sort of insidery is that the fact that the state auditor is hiring former or current Berger staffers and moving them over to the state auditor's office, which is where the Board of Elections is said to be moving to, depending on how these court battles play out. That's just one thing that like piqued my interest. It made me wonder, like, maybe they don't think there's going to be a stay on the Board of Elections moving. Maybe they think it'll be under immediately the state auditor's office. So I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to say.
Yeah, I think it has to wind its way up to the state Supreme Court, but obviously the state Supreme Court has a very strong Republican majority. So I think Republicans feel fairly confident that when it gets to that level, they may come out on top with their constitutional argument about this.
And Brian, let me cut in just real quickly. So for people who are not following as closely, the way it has worked forever and ever is that the governor chooses the state elections board with a limit of 3 members from his party and then 2 from the other. It's a 5-member board. Okay, go ahead, Brian. And the change would be that the state auditor will now oversee that, and the new state auditor is a Republican. I know y'all know this, but just for context, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, exactly. I'm neither smart nor bold enough to predict what a court will ultimately do. but I will say the political reality is that the state Supreme Court, unlike previous cases, is now under Republican control. So you have a 5-2 conservative majority. That's not going away anytime soon. So even if this takes years to resolve, that conservative state Supreme Court will still be in place through at least 2028. That's what we know. It's hard for me to see a scenario where this doesn't get resolved by 2028. And the conservative state Supreme Court has been very highly deferential to state lawmakers. So that's the track record. But there is also recent judicial precedent of separation of powers, siding with the governor. So, there's more to watch.
Lucille.
Yeah, sorry. One last thing worth noting is there are Republicans, former Governor Pat McCrory, a Republican, disagrees with this move. So there are other Republicans who want the legislature to let the governor or let there be sort of more bipartisan control of the State Board of Elections.
Go ahead, Brian.
And it's worth noting there was an issue that went to voters back in 2018, and the question was basically presented, do you want a bipartisan Board of Elections? And that was basically a GOP effort by lawmakers to take power away from the governor. And voters overwhelmingly rejected that, and that was in Republican-friendly counties, Democrat-friendly counties. So the idea of stripping power from the governor and giving some advantage to Republicans is something that even many Republicans, like Lucille said, have been opposed to.
And since we're mentioning the state Supreme Court so frequently in this part of the show, again, Allison Riggs, the incumbent Democrat, defeated her Republican challenger, Jefferson Griffin, by about 700 votes out of 5.5 million ballots cast. We've had 2 recounts. Griffin continues to push for about 60,000 ballots to be disqualified. I have a couple of questions about this since y'all are much closer to it. The first one's very basic. We have a 5-2 advantage for Republicans on the state Supreme Court. So why are they fighting this so hard? Or is it more Griffin, or is it Republicans too? In other words, what I'm saying is 6-1, 5-2, you're still going to win.
Well, what we have right now is Riggs is leading that race by 700 plus votes. And what we had seen in 2020 was Democrats had lost that race by about 400 votes. And so one thing that happened in 2020, Sherry Beasley, she lost that state Supreme Court race. She demanded a recount. She asked for a second recount. After that second recount happened, she conceded, and that was the end of the story. What's different this time is you have Jefferson Griffin, who by all accounts has lost. The only reason this race hasn't been formally called is just honestly because of the judicial makeup of the court. The federal court, a federal court judge, a Trump-appointed judge, had rejected nearly identical claims before the election and found that there was procedural reasons why it couldn't go forward, and there was a logical reason that it couldn't be considered, and that Trump-appointed judge had worried about concerns of democracy and part of his decision. And that exact same issue is being brought back to that judge. So what we have was Jefferson Griffin said, hey, I think I can get a favorable decision possibly from the state Supreme Court. State Board of Elections said, no, we're going to have to make sure it goes through federal court. That's where it currently is. And so what Griffin is effectively arguing is for the results of this election to be overturned based on an argument that's already been rejected by the very judge now considering this matter.
I think this is a lot of aspects as a test case for Republicans to see if you have a friendly court, can you find technicalities, in this case, people who didn't have their driver's license number correctly filled out on their registration form. This is not talking about people who committed felonies who are voting or people who are dead or non-citizens who are voting. These are people who, by all intents, are eligible to vote, but didn't fill the forms out correctly. And so this is a test of if you have a really close election, can you get a favorable court to throw out this many ballots to change the outcome? Or is that a bridge too far, even with a Republican-led court? And we'll see if that happens or not, because we'll see if the, as Brian mentioned, the state Supreme Court is the ultimate arbiter of this, or if it goes to federal court. And we don't necessarily see how this plays out on the state level.
And sorry, just really quick, the state Board of Elections already concluded that there's not enough votes for Griffin to overcome his deficit. That's already been concluded based on the amount of potential votes, still not 100% decided.
Colin, I'm curious when I think about the past 8 years, the transfer of power in North Carolina has resulted in a tangle of legal challenges and maneuvers. And we obviously have all the gerrymandering that's gone on, 30 years plus. Do you think this sort of combination of fights is the new normal for North Carolina?
It certainly seems like it. We've had several. This feels a lot like the post-2016 election, where you had McCrory contested the results for a month or so before conceding. You had the power grab laws at the legislature at that point. I feel like we're sort of into a pattern now where this is kind of how this plays out, given how close elections are and a sort of split ticket on the voter side of, putting Democrats in charge of the governor's mansion, but Republicans in charge of other offices, including the legislature.
We are going to take one more break, and then we're going to continue with our conversation about what's ahead politically in North Carolina for 2025. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and our conversation continues about what's next in North Carolina politics with our panel of experts, Lucille Sherman from Axios Raleigh, Brian Anderson from the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, and WUNC's Colin Campbell. As you well know, the General Assembly has its long session coming up starting this month, and developing a two-year budget is their top priority, but they'll have plenty of other things on the menu as well. Phil Berger still runs the Senate. Josh Stein, as we discussed, is the new governor. And for the first time in 10 years, Tim Moore is not the House Speaker. Moore is headed to Congress, and he'll be replaced by Destin Hall. What kind of speaker is Destin Hall likely to be?
I think that's the big question mark, right? I mean, Destin Hall has been the rules chairman, which is sort of a deputy role to the House Speaker for the last several years. And in many respects, I think politically aligned with Tim Moore, at least in that role. Whether we see a different leadership style from him, different policy preferences, I think remains to be seen. What's interesting about Hall is he will be, I think, one of the youngest, if not the youngest, speaker in history. He's 37, the same age as me, which feels weird to have a House Speaker who is the same age as you, attorney from up in the Lenora area. And it'll be really interesting to see, there's been a lot of times over the last decade or so where the Senate has had the upper hand in these sort of intra-Republican Party fights over budgets, tax cuts, et cetera. And whether that continues to be the case, or whether Hall proves to be sort of an equally strong negotiator to Phil Berger on the Senate side, we'll see when it comes budget time this year, I think.
Yeah, I'd echo all of that. I think one thing worth noting, also a little insidery aside, is that Dustin Hall is keeping a lot of Tim Moore's staff on board. So it's a small note, but something I feel like could be indicative of what kind of speaker he'll be. He's discussed sort of having a more consistent and predictable schedule, which the outsiders may not have a big impact on legislative, what gets through the legislature, but I think could be a big change inside the state house. And as Colin alluded to, we might see a completely different relationship between the Senate and House. And I think that's sort of the most notable of all, is that we're already sort of seeing, I think, the makings of what seems like a good relationship between the House and Senate, which is notable considering, you know, in the final months and years of Speaker Tim Moore's term, I feel like the relationship sort of between the House and Senate was slipping a little bit.
Yeah. What about, I want to ask you, Brian, a related note on this idea of, you know, you don't have the veto override, but there's already been speculation that, you know, it's sort of a supermajority in practice because you're going to have one or two Democrats that may slide over and join the Republicans. What do you make of that as part of this transfer to Destin Hall from Tim Moore?
Well, I mean, Lucille broke the story of Trisha Cotham's party switch. So, I mean, there's certainly now precedent for party switching to happen and create a GOP supermajority. I think if you had to ask who's the likeliest of the 49 Democrats to do that, maybe Cecil Brockman of Guilford County. It's worth noting that unlike the lead up to the 2024 election, this time there's no mid-decade redistricting. So there's not as much Republicans can maybe offer Brockman other than maybe chairmanships, more say in the budget process. So there's fewer carrots that can be offered to get someone to switch parties. Not to say that that's not possible or can't happen, but the real governing supermajority potential may more likely be if you have two Democrats who are absent. There was a vote on September 11th, 2019. And since then, I'd argue the legislature hasn't been the same. There's been growing distrust, and there was basically a surprise budget vote that happened then. There's fears that something similar could happen again in the future. We have Brockman, who's habitually absent from the legislature. That's one person. There are other Democrats who have illnesses, who have doctor's appointments that might come up. And if you pair that and Brockman absent at the same time, that's enough for Republicans to do what they want.
Yeah,
and 60% of who's there, just real quickly, Colin, I want to make sure on the technicality there is that it's 60% of who's in the room, not the overall 60% unless they're all there, correct?
Yeah, exactly. You don't actually need 72 votes unless all 120 members are there in voting. Somebody could potentially be absent. They could just take a walk and not happen to cast a vote. And that doesn't necessarily cast the math is different depending on how many people vote. Sort of adding to Brian's point, I think there's multiple sort of moderate Democrats to watch. And on any given issue, any of them could be a vote to override a veto from Governor Stein. In the Charlotte area, you guys have a Democratic representative, Carla Cunningham, who has in the past voted with Republicans and may continue to do so. There are a couple others as well. So even if no one actually formally puts an R next to their name and switches party the way Trisha Cotham did, Republicans may be able to get that one Democratic vote they need on any given issue. And if it's an issue where they don't, then, you know, wait a while and see who's absent or has a doctor's appointment.
And y'all mentioned Cecil Brockman, the High Point Democrat. He had some pretty strong words for Democrats to the effect of, you need me, I don't necessarily need you. How much, you know, sincerity or how much of a threat do you really think that is at this point?
It's so hard to say with a new governor in office, because one thing that made sort of it more certain that Democrats were going to fall in line in the past 8 years was Governor Cooper's power. He was sort of able to get people in line when push came to shove. It's an open question. You know, Stein is a new governor. He may not have the same influence over those Democratic legislators that might be willing to move. So I think that's more of the question is, you know, how much muscle will the Stein administration have in making sure he keeps his party in line?
And I mentioned, go ahead, Brian.
House Democrats are very, very, very internally worried about Brockman. not necessarily just how he'd vote, but whether he'll show up. And as I had reported a while back, he had considered at one point even switching parties already. So that's something he has already considered. And my understanding is there's undoubtedly going to be a serious lobbying effort to make that happen again. House Democrats, if they're very worried, other folks should probably take Brockman very seriously at his word.
Beyond the budget, which we know is an eternal battle, what else is likely to surface, as contentious issues in this next session?
I'll be keeping an eye on medical marijuana. We have Senator Bill Rabin as the champion of that issue, as someone who has used marijuana for his own cancer treatment. And I think it will be interesting to see. Rabin seems like he might be winding down in his time as a state lawmaker, and he said he will not leave until medical marijuana is passed. So I'll be interested to see if that is an issue that actually gets passed. It's very narrowly not made it to the House floor in recent years, or very narrowly sort of been pushed back by House lawmakers, House Republicans in particular. But there's constantly been movement. There's tons of new lawmakers. The landscape of that issue could totally change in the next 2 years.
Yeah, and I think if the House does decide to bring that to a vote, if Dustin Hall is willing to put that on the floor in ways that Tim Moore was not, I think you see that bill pass into law, particularly if it's paired with some regulations for the CBD and hemp industry, which has been sought by the House, including the new House Rules Chairman, which will be John Bell, who was the majority leader, who actually is the president of a company that sells CBD and hemp products. So that's one to watch. I think Helene is probably going to be the number one item on the to-do list as they come back, now that we finally have Congress having taken action on federal funding, which was something the state level leaders were waiting for. A lot of that's going to have to get doled out by the legislature to individual programs, and then the legislature is going to have to look and see what did Congress and the federal government not pay for with the array of post-Helene needs in Western North Carolina, and what does state funding need to do. I was up in the Spruce Pine area last month, one of the hardest hit parts, and they really don't feel like they're getting a lot so far from either the state or the federal government in terms of the big needs, getting businesses back open, getting people back in their homes. And now that we have this federal funding and the state's ability to do stuff with that federal funding, I think that's going to be a big issue going forward of exactly what's the Fed's role, what's the state's role, and how do we actually get some traction on some of these things that these areas desperately need.
Brian, do we expect anything more on two of the big issues from recent sessions, which would be abortion and private school vouchers?
Well, they have expanded opportunity scholarships already. So maybe if the demand continues to exceed expectations, maybe there might be additional funding down the line. It seems for now, at least, that issue they see as resolved, but maybe more to come in the future. As for one thing that I think will be worth watching, might just be the dynamic between Berger and Hall. Berger had really pushed for casinos last year and was unsuccessful in that effort. With Moore out of the picture, is Berger more emboldened to try and go back to that in a budget negotiation talk? I do think Helene is the top priority. I think Lucille hit the nail on the head that medical marijuana will be an important subject of conversation. I think casino expansion might be a harder reach and a harder lift for Berger, but that's something to watch as well.
Yeah, and I think on that abortion issue, I would be surprised if we see anything come to the floor. I'm almost certain that some Republicans, the more socially conservative Republicans, will file some legislation that would make more abortion restrictions, maybe a heartbeat bill or something. I haven't seen an appetite among leadership to bring that to the floor and bring that to a vote, in part because they will have very narrow supermajorities. So the likelihood that you get something like that across the finish line in this political dynamic seems pretty slim.
And in 2022, that was a terrible issue for Republicans. Do you really want to do that again going into a 2026 election? It's probably not on your to-do list.
That's the voice of Brian Anderson. He is the author of the Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter. Also with us is Colin Campbell from WUNC and Lucille Sherman of Axios Raleigh. We discussed Destin Hall, the new speaker, earlier. Senate Democrats made a big leadership change as well, replacing Dan Blue as minority leader with Sidney Batch. Blue is 75, Batch is 45. So this is a big generational shift. Blue told you, Brian, that it was a coup. What's driving this?
What's driving it is a frustration among Democrats, in part for a lack of progress they've seen. You know, there's still 30 seats that Republicans had a supermajority, and they retained that supermajority. And Blue is the leader of the Senate Democratic Caucus. So some point blame to him. He'll say, you know, we had worse maps this cycle. That's just the political reality that Senate Democrats were facing. And so I think there's an appetite for a fresh face from Blue's colleagues. And that took him and some other people by surprise. Whether or not Sidney Batch can be the person to turn a very unfavorable map into one that Senate Democrats can break a supermajority come 2026 remains to be seen. But I think Democrats are just frustrated and hoping for a new direction.
Particularly in this part of the state, we don't know a lot about Senator Sidney Batch. What stands out about her?
Yeah, so I've covered Sidney Batch for years now. She joined the legislature in the state house representing Southern Wake County in 2018 as part of that blue wave in the Trump administration. She ran again in 2020 and lost in the state house, and then was appointed to the state Senate to replace a fellow Wake state senator shortly after her loss. So she's been in the state Senate since. She is a prolific fundraiser, which is a big reason I think she was tapped to sort of lead the caucus. She's a fresh face. She's a mother of two young children, which is not something that we see a lot of in the state legislature. There's lots of talk about need for representation of sort of more diverse folks in the state legislature, and she's certainly that. And I think one thing that she might want to bring to the table is sort of a different strategy in fighting back Republicans or countering Republican efforts in the legislature. And that will be what I'll be watching most closely, is sort of how do Senate Democrats respond to Republican efforts in the coming years.
Lucille, you mentioned that she is a mom, and you recently reported that I think it was 7% of state lawmakers are moms. And Colin separately wrote that 30% of state lawmakers are women, which is below the national average. For each of you, what's holding back female candidates?
I think a huge part of it is that legislative pay is $14,000 a year. That makes it super difficult for people who need to make a salary or don't have flexible full-time jobs to make their way to Raleigh in the state legislature. Note that Sidney Batch is a Wake County lawmaker, so she it's a little bit easier for her to get to the state legislature.
Colin, do you see similar things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the low pay and the sort of erratic schedule makes it really hard if you are not independently wealthy or have a job that kind of runs itself to be in Raleigh this month. And so you really have very few people who are in that boat. Heck, as you know, Lucille and I are both parents of young children. As a full-time job covering the legislature, it's hard to keep up with their schedule. I'd hate to imagine trying to do that and have another job on the side, on the other side of the state.
We cannot end this show without touching on the topic of what Roy Cooper does next, because I think a lot of people are looking at Cooper Tillis as sort of a perhaps sequel to Hunt Helms back in 84. Do you think it will happen? And I'll let you start, Colin.
Yeah, I would not be at all surprised if we see that come up this round again.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. I won't be surprised. What I am looking to is February. Former Congressman Wiley Nickel, a Democrat, has said that he'll announce whether he's going to run for Senate. Mm-hmm. So I'll be interested to see if there's any pressure for Cooper to announce at the same time or before then, or if that actually happens. It'll be interesting to see. I know that's everybody's biggest question.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what do you think?
He'll probably run, Cooper. And won't be surprised. The only reason to not run would be if you think Trump's getting off to a good start in his presidency and you don't think the midterm elections will be a good cycle for you. Cooper's very practical. That's why he's won every election he's running. That would be the only thing keeping him back.
Lucy, I'm going to give you the last word, which is, if that matchup occurs, do you think it will be a nasty race?
Hard to say. I do think one thing that will be a focus for Tom Tillis is his moderate efforts in the last few years. Unsure if that will make it nasty per se.
That, as I say, will have to be the last word. I want to thank Lucille Sherman from Axios Raleigh, Brian Anderson of the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, and Colin Campbell from WUNC. Be careful up there in Raleigh.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks, for Eric.
For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks so much for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.